Hello and thank you for joining this episode of Haaretz Weekly. With you in studio, Amir Tibon.
And Allison Kaplan-Summer.
Filling in for Simon Spangin. On today's episode, a bit later, we'll talk with Rabbi Gilad Kariv, once upon a time the most prominent Reform Rabbi in Israel, and today a member of Knesset from the Labor Party, the first non-Orthodox Rabbi in Israel to get elected.
And we'll ask him about the new Israeli government and where they stand on issues of religion and state.
But before that... On September 15, 2020, almost a year ago today, Israel signed normalization agreements with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, two Arab countries that up to that point had no official diplomatic relations with it. A year after the signing of those agreements, new stories are emerging about the years-long secret diplomacy that paved the way for that day on the White House lawn. And with us to discuss those new revelations is Gili Cohen, diplomatic correspondent for Israel's Kan Broadcasting, who recently released a new documentary series, The Secrets of Peace, about the long diplomatic process that led to the signing of those agreements.
Hi, Gili.
If Gili's name sounds familiar to some of our listeners, that is because she's also a Haaretz alumni and our former defense reporter.
It's great to be back at Haaretz again.
Yeah, great for us, Gili. We are also meeting on the day that Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is holding his first visit to Egypt as Prime Minister, the second Arab country that he's visited after Jordan. Maybe before we go to the Abraham Accords and the history, we'll talk a bit about the history being made today. What is important about this visit, Bennett going to Egypt?
It's official. And it's out there. And the one that told the media about this visit is Assisi. So I think this is represent the change between Prime Minister Bennett and Prime Minister Netanyahu, who visited Egypt several times, most of the times with no publicity, with no media. And nowadays, it seems like Assisi is trying to highlight the fact that he is hosting Prime Minister Bennett, that he is trying to revive the Middle East peace process, that he is trying to be the one that is in charge of those efforts to promote peace in the Middle East. Good luck with that. but nowadays, I think that he has even more greater role by saying that Prime Minister Bennett is coming to Egypt when there's 3 days in a row rockets that are launching towards Israel. And Egypt is the most powerful player in order to have de-escalation.
Some ceasefire in Gaza, even though it's not a war, but maybe we'll need them soon.
Exactly. We need them right now. Yes. It's three days in a row, as you know.
Yes.
He lives in the neighborhood.
Yes.
Amir lives on the border of Gaza.
Yes.
Exactly. So I think this even adding more incentive for this publicity, for the fact that Prime Minister Bennett is nowadays being in Egypt, talking with Assisi about Gaza, about the Palestinians, about the efforts here in the Middle East. And he is trying to promote himself as the player in this neighborhood. And I think that Bennett is trying to promote himself as well as the new player in this playground. And we will know, I think, later on if this meeting has any, you know, things that we can measure, or just, you know, the niceties of having the Israeli prime minister for the first time for a decade in Sharm el-Sheikh, escorting by all of his people, of the Israeli prime minister. Perhaps it will be just, you know, the headline of the visit, but that's all for now, and it's a great, you know, a process within the relationship between the two countries.
And this is ongoing. It's happening as we are recording.
Yeah. So, Gili, back to your deep dive into the Abraham Accords. When the agreements were signed, Donald Trump was still president of the U.S. and Benjamin Netanyahu was the prime minister of Israel. So we're a year later, new occupants of both offices. So how do you see the Biden administration and the Bennett-Lapid government in Israel treating these accords? And is there any hope? Can we expect any kind of similar breakthroughs with other Arab countries in the coming year?
Well, I think that this is the main question that we should all ask ourselves. If it's a personal personal issue between those two leaders, which we can be critical about their role, their efforts, but they're Prime Minister Netanyahu was been in charge for 12 years. He had a great legacy. Abraham Accords is one of it. And I think that for President Trump, it's also one of his topic on his legacy. But we need to ask ourselves two things. First, if it's just, you know, the leaders that led or paved the way to this breakthrough, or is it something else, or is it a connection between the people, between the nations, something that will last for decades? So I have two things to say about it. First, I just checked the numbers. Within this year, more than 230,000 Israelis visit the UAE. We basically conquered the UAE.
Almost a quarter of a million Israelis have already visited the UAE since it was signed.
And it's in a year of COVID, which it's insane.
There was some connection beyond, right? They said that, yeah, that some of the COVID actually came from there over here.
Yeah. Vice versa, perhaps.
Yes.
But I think that we can learn from that Israelis were eager to explore the UAE, were eager to get to know the country and be in Dubai and having selfies in the, you know, with all the specialties that Dubai had to offer.
Shopping.
Exactly. And great hotels and restaurants too.
So you were there, Gil. You can give us later a complete list.
So this is from one hand. By the way, there were fewer of Emiratis that came to Israel for a visit. It's non-comparable. But we should ask ourselves again if it's more than tourism and businesses, and if it's more than economy in general. And I think that it's not yet there. There are no really big investments and really big corporation and really big issues that both of the countries are trying to promote together. And by that, I think that the new administration in the U.S. has something with that. When I was, I will have a spoiler for my series, The Secret of Peace, that I've been working on in the last months. I've been talking about this question a lot. Is it something that we should expect new countries to join to the Abraham Accords? And all of the Israeli officials that I've talked with say the same thing, that we need to have a great support of the U.S. administration in order to achieve more and more countries to this project. And they are not there yet. It's on their agenda. I will say that it perhaps in their top 10 topics on their agenda, but it's surely not on their, you know, top 3 or even top 5. They discussed in Bennett's Biden meeting in the last weeks, they were discussing more about the CCC, COVID, climate, and China, and not having more countries to join the Abraham Accords, or call it whatever you want. They are not mentioning the names as Trump.
The Biden administration is calling it just what, normalization deals? Right.
They're not saying, by the way, that they are, you know, ignoring the name, but they will not repeat it on camera, on record. They are saying normalization, they are saying the agreements, the process between Israel and the Gulf states, but I can't remember even one time that I've heard official administration that is talking and mentioned the name Abraham Accords. By the way, I've talked about the same thing with former minister Gabi Ashkenazi, former foreign minister, and he was saying, I haven't remember any time that they have problem with the name. So perhaps it's just, you know, something that we as journalists...
anecdotal thing.
Exactly,
that we
for us and not for them. But we should ask ourselves if... are they in the same route as we are in this process?
And but I think, beyond the branding, do you hear that in the State Department, for some reason, this initiative is tainted by the fact that it was Donald Trump's
And Bibi Netanyahu.
And Bibi Netanyahu's triumph, and therefore it's kind of hard for Biden to build on it when America is such a partisan moment?
Well, let's be honest. I think that if Saudi Arabia was just across the street, it will happen. But it's not. We have to have more persuasion and more efforts in order to make this big issue to happen. There are some countries that were seems to be more on track with Israel. Oman, for instance, it is a country that hosts Prime Minister Netanyahu for an official visit back then in 2018, if I'm not mistaken. And on the same day that Lapid and his colleague, foreign minister of Oman, were talking, they will later deliver a statement saying, we will not be the next country to have formal ties with Israel. And it means, first of all, there were change in their head of state, but it means that there is a certain gap that is still there. And I don't think, I'm not seeing any great efforts from the administration to hold this gap.
In your documentary series on Khan Broadcast, The Secrets of Peace, you discuss several secrets that were involved in this long process to reach the Abraham Accords. One of them is that Gabi Ashkenazi, the foreign minister in Netanyahu's previous government that you just mentioned, at one point threatened to blow up the signing ceremony.
Not literally.
Basically, threatened is a strong word, deliberated whether he should pull the plug on it. But what was that all about?
Well, I think that this is just a great example for just a bit of the intrigues and the emotions that were involved between Ashkenazi and Netanyahu, between the Israeli government and between the efforts and the process of those normalization. Ashkenazi, as the foreign minister, he is the person that needs to sign the agreement.
And because it's with a foreign country.
Exactly. And it is a peace treaty. Mm. And Netanyahu, which were for a decade a foreign minister, perhaps he forgot the fact that he is not the foreign minister anymore. And Ashkenazi had to authorize Netanyahu to sign instead of him. And he is telling us that he was a bit of, he thought about it a lot.
Whether he should say, let
Netanyahu
do that. Yeah,
he hesitates whether to, you know, to be in this side of the history or not. He was telling me that he thought that he should be invited to the ceremony, but Netanyahu didn't invite anyone. Except, by the way, the head of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, which is the only one that had the opportunity to escort Prime Minister Netanyahu with all the people and the plane to the White House.
Was he invited, Yossi Cohen, the former head of Mossad, because he played a role in reaching the agreements, or more because just Netanyahu likes him more?
Yeah, it depends who you ask. Mm-hmm. he had a certain role. I'm not sure he had the major role. I think that in this case, when we are talking about the UAE, the more influential person was Jared Kushner, or Prime Minister Netanyahu, or Ron Dermer, Yosef Al-Taiba.
It's a piece that started in Washington, in that sense.
Exactly, exactly. And we were on board even later.
Do you think Ashkenazi was seriously considering doing this?
Yes, yeah. Yes. He described in our series that he had talks with Prime Minister office members that trying to pursue him to sign. And it was when Netanyahu was in Washington already, like a day before the event, and they were all waiting for the big sign of Gabi Ashkenazi, not of Donald Trump and Netanyahu.
So you interview a person in your series who has a code name, Maoz, that's his intelligence name. So who is this man and what exactly was his role in Israel's secret relationship with the Gulf countries?
Yes. So I think that this is part of the story, that the people who were involved from the Israeli side are classified. Most of them are ex-Mossad or ex-Shin Bet. Maoz is an ex-Shin Bet officer. He is...
And we're not allowed to say his full name.
Exactly. He was one of National Security Advisor Mey Ben Shabbat, right-hand man, worked with him in the Shin Bet, and he transferred him to the NSC. And they were both negotiate the relationship between Israel and foreign countries in Africa and in the Gulf. And he had a special role because he is a Shin Bet person. And he basically tried to recruit those people to be on Israel's side. And he was, for example, talking with me about the fact that under those secret flights, he asked his wife to bring cookies with him. And he, on every flight, had a special gift for his counterpart, with cookies from his wife.
Homemade.
Homemade cookies from Israel the country.
This is how you gain diplomatic trust today, apparently.
Exactly. By the way, this is a part of the issues and of the conflicts that were escorting all these efforts. The fact that most of the people were not diplomats. It wasn't on the path of diplomacy. It wasn't the path of more
security-oriented people, Intel,
cyber issues, those kind of persons, which is, you know, the opposite of diplomacy.
Interesting. Is there a sense in the professional ranks, let's call it, whether in the intelligence community or foreign ministry, that Netanyahu took credit for these accords and sidelined other people who contributed?
Yes, for sure. As I've mentioned, the fact that he was the only one, you know, on front of those efforts. He talked about Netanyahu's doctrine, peace for peace. He talked about the fact that he is the only one who can get peace agreements nowadays. And look what happened. Yes, but I think that we must remember that he had a truly vibrant role, an important role on those Abraham Accords. I think that without Netanyahu, it wouldn't happen. And we need to remember that when nowadays we're talking about the fact that Netanyahu is not the prime minister anymore and is watching about the process from a different perspective.
So a big question that still is kind of unresolved in the wake of the accords is about the sale of the F-35 planes to the United Arab Emirates. Were you able to find an explicit link, a real quid pro quo between the accords and the sale? Did Israel actually give Trump a clear flashing green light?
Again, it depends who you're asking. Ashkenazi and Gantz told me on record, totally yes, that they understood from their officials, from their colleagues in the U.S., that Israel gave the okay for that, for the selling. Meir Ben Shabbat, on his first interview, told me totally no. So, again, it depends who you are asking.
And Netanyahu publicly denied it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. By the way, Netanyahu refused to be interviewed to our Syria. I don't know why. I'm asking myself again and again why.
Wouldn't it be in his interest to talk for a documentary series about one of his proudest achievements?
And yet, he refused.
Wonder why.
Well, let's invite him on the podcast and see. Maybe to haaretz.com podcast, he will come and talk about
this. I think that the Haaretz and Kan, the Israeli public broadcasting, is, you know, both of them are not
his favorite media outlet.
Exactly.
Yeah. We'll hear it on Israel Hayom.
Yeah. So when the accords were signed, many people in Israel said, okay, this marks the final death of the issue of the Palestinians, that when we see even the Arab world was moving away from the Palestinians, getting close to Israel, being ready to sign a peace agreement, a normalization agreement without taking the Palestinians into account. 12 months later, a year later, how does that argument look?
Well, the Palestinians are still here to stay. And we opened the conversation about the role of Egypt in trying to de-escalate Gaza. And I think that for the Israeli perspective and for the Israeli daily life, this is much more important than the Abraham Accords. Perhaps I'm mistaken, I don't know. But I think that in the long term, those relationships are much more influence on our daily life. We can travel to Dubai and have fun, but then we need to come back to the reality.
And the Gaza wars are like our reminders, like, you know, we're still here.
And
it's still here.
And let's all remember the war in May, which have, you know, an impact of about the peace agreements that were signed less than a year before that. And the UAE had difficulties with Israel's approach towards Jerusalem. And once again, we notice that it's a complicated neighborhood to handle. And Israeli officials had, harsh talks with their colleagues with the UAE, saying you need to stop the aggressive activities in Jerusalem. And it changed that whole perspective. It is not just, you know, tourism treaty. It's more than that. And if we want to have relationship with countries, with Muslim countries that have different perspective about this area, about the Middle East, we need to take into consideration also this.
Yeah, I like the Gili summary. We can go to Dubai, but Gaza stays here with us.
Exactly.
Gili Cohen from Kan Broadcast, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And up next, after the break, we'll have Rabbi Gilad Kariv.
Member of Knesset Gilad Kariv, thank you for being with us today.
Shalom and Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
Do you miss being a rabbi these days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur?
Well, actually, yes. Before I met the challenge of COVID-19, I had some plans to be to officiate as a rabbi in Yom Kippur in one of the new minyanim, the new congregations of the Reform movement. Unfortunately, I can't do it. But yes, I miss the rabbinical work. I miss the communal experience of leading a congregation. But I know that I'm serving our movement and our crowds from here in the Knesset, so it's okay. And you know what? It's a good idea after 25 years of leading high holiday services to be a simple Jew that sits in the synagogue and prays.
So let's talk a little bit about the journey you've taken over the past year. It is, after all, the time of year where we're supposed to reflect on what we've been through. Let's say a year ago, we met you in your synagogue and we told you that after running for Knesset many times, five times, right, you've been you went through elections, you would finally be a member of Knesset and you would be part of the ruling coalition. So you would have the power to make change. But here's the twist. We would tell you that Naftali Bennett was going to be prime minister and you would be part of a coalition that would range from Yamina to Meretz. How do you think Gilad Kariv would respond a year ago to that?
So let's separate the different scenarios. I think that a year ago when I was fully occupied in supporting our 50 congregations across the country to run high holiday services in spite of the pandemic, I didn't think that I will try again to run in a Labor primaries. First, because I tried it for four times, and second, because of the bad situation, the catastrophic situation of the Labor Party a year ago. But then came Rav Michaeli, the chairperson of our party, and succeeded in a few weeks to revive the party. I know Merav Michaeli for many years as one of the leaders of the Reform movement, and it was an exciting opportunity, and I took the decision to try again. In regard to the structure of the government, I must say that it was very clear to me a year ago that the only option to move former Prime Minister Netanyahu from his office is to build a wide unity government. It was clear to me that currently the central left Zionist camp in Israel doesn't have the political ability to end Netanyahu term and to run a central left government. I must admit that I didn't think Naftali Bennett is the leading candidate to become the prime minister, but I was not surprised by the fact that we are now part of a national unity government. This part is not surprising for me.
What do you say to people on the left who feel a bit sour about this eclectic coalition, who complain that Labor and Meretz have allegedly given up too much to the right-wing partners like Bennett and Gideon Saar and Avigdor Lieberman?
So first I can share with them that there are many, many people on the right side of the political map that feel the same. Okay? And I think that it's a good sign. It's a good sign because by definition, when you are building a national unity government, and here in Israel, we have, in the end, a positive experience with national unity governments. By definition, you need to make many compromises. Now, I belong to this massive Israeli crowd that truly thought that the Israeli democracy and the Israeli social fabric is under a real threat from the or by the continuation of Netanyahu's government. And by definition, politics is all about priorities. And our main priority for the sake of the future of Israeli democracy, for the future of the Israeli society, was to end Netanyahu's term, and we succeeded to do it. Now, if you look carefully into the coalition agreements, and you know what? If you look carefully into the upcoming national budget, you will see immediately the massive footprints of the Labour Party and Meretz and also blue and white. This is not a central left government. This is a national unity government, and we need to judge it according to this basic nature of it. And keeping in mind this basic fact, I think that also both in the coalition agreements, but more important, in the things that were done here in the Knesset and in the government in the last few months, you can see the impact or the influence of our ministers and our Knesset members.
Many progressive Reform Jews in the diaspora got used to looking at you as their man in Jerusalem who would lobby on the issues that were important to them. And now you're on the inside and they're looking to you with a lot of hope and expectation that that things can finally move on issues they care about, the Kotel, conversions, etc. From inside the coalition, do you have any good news for people who are watching and waiting on those important issues?
Yes, I think that already today we can share some important developments, and I'll do it in a second. But first I want to say that because we are part of a national unity government, and because this government has a very thin majority, and you know, because issues of religion and state are at the heart of the political and sociological Israeli debate, here also people need to understand that it will take some time and some things will be achieved this round, and other things will be achieved in the next round if we prepare ourselves in the right manner, politically speaking. Now, the good news are first the fact that this new government is not trying to challenge any of our past achievements. I want to remind the listeners that a major part of the ultra-Orthodox Party's campaign was to overrule the Supreme Court rulings in regard to the status of non-Orthodox conversions. And here we have a government that includes an Orthodox Israeli party, and not for a single moment this issue of blocking the non-Orthodox conversions was part of the negotiation and negotiations. And this is a major shift. Second, and I know that some of the listeners already know it, besides the fact that today the Labour Party, with our pluralistic philosophy, is leading the Ministry of Diaspora Affairs, my good friend, Dr. Nachman Shai, is the Minister of Diaspora Affairs. We are now building a new wing in this department that will work with the non-Orthodox Israeli movements and organizations. And for the first time, will offer governmental support to the important cause of promoting pluralistic Judaism in Israel. This is the first time that an Israeli government is allocating money and government resources to promote the pluralistic Israeli movements and organizations. It is clear that we have a strong majority inside the government and the coalition to renew the Kotel agreement.
Yeah, this is the one issue I think our listeners were yeah. most anxious to hear from you about. Where when, that one is going?
When will people
I want to say one thing to your listeners. I fully agree that the Kotel issue is critical. I was deeply, deeply involved in a personal manner in the negotiations in 2016. I'm using all my opportunities in the Knesset to attack the former Prime Minister Netanyahu for the damage he created inside the Jewish world around this issue. But it's important that our listeners, your listeners around the world, will understand that the Kotel is a critical issue, but our ability to build the infrastructures of the non-Orthodox movements to support the Israeli Reform and Conservative and unaffiliated egalitarian congregations, our ability to expose the values and the work of our movements in Israel, those things are not less important. Now, we have a very strong belief, and actually we know that after the government and the Knesset approve the national budget in the coming few weeks, the government will address the issue of the Kotel. There is a strong alliance inside the coalition that is actually calling and working for the a total renewal of the Kotel agreement. And I'm sure that Prime Minister Netanyahu, Prime Minister Bennett.
We are so used to the past, yeah. But Prime Minister Bennett.
After 12 years, it takes time.
Yes.
You know, to clean our collective mind. Believe me that when I'm doing this mistake and I'm repairing myself and saying Prime Minister Bennett, I'm smiling. I'm sure that Prime Minister Bennett will address this issue. The Minister of Foreign Affairs and the secondary Prime Minister or the alternative Prime Minister, Yair Lapid, who is playing a critical role in this government, said in a very clear way that this government will bring justice to the wall, and I'm sure that it will happen. And again, I want to remind all of us that one of the major side effects of what the former government did with the Kotel agreement was the fact that the former Prime Minister Netanyahu just ended any dialogue with the leadership of the non-Orthodox movements in Israel and overseas. It wasn't only about the Kotel, the women of the wall, our ability to have egalitarian bar and bat mitzvot. Actually, the current leader of the opposition, Benjamin Netanyahu, turned his back to millions of progressive and liberal Jews around the world. And this is something that definitely will not happen in this government. Mm-hmm. There is new music here in Jerusalem, a new attitude towards the non-Orthodox streams. The fact that I'm leading the Knesset Constitutional Committee, and this is something, a mission I received from the coalition, tells something about the way the new government and coalition understand the role of the non-Orthodox movements.
Uh-huh.
And we are planning to push it forward.
You mentioned the committee that you're leading, and of course one of the big issues on the agenda is COVID. And actually right now the entire world is looking at Israel and how we are handling the current Delta wave. Do you think the government has this under control?
Yes, I need to say that as the chair of the Constitutional Committee, most of the Knesset discussions about COVID-19, about the pandemic, are brought to my committee. I'm not saying that there are things that we need to deal with. I'm not suggesting that there are no challenges and even failures. We live in an era of uncertainty, and mistakes are a natural part of any government policy in regard to COVID-19. But generally speaking, I need to say that after the two waves of vaccinations, I believe that Prime Minister Bennett's decision to open the schools, to enable the Israeli economy to revive itself, to take off the table any option of total lockdown, this is the right attitude. Unfortunately, we'll have to deal with this pandemic probably many months ahead. And we need to find a way to, as the government is saying, we need to find a way to live with the pandemic and not to kill it, because unfortunately, COVID-19 is in many ways is here to stay. And I think that especially the decision to open the schools, I think that Israel, that was one of the leading Western countries, unfortunately, a year ago, in the number of days that the schools are shut down, I think that we created unintentionally a massive social and emotional and educational damage to tens of thousands of Israeli children. And this government is not willing to repeat this mistake. And for me, from a Jewish perspective and from a democratic perspective, opening the schools is the top priority.
So for you, COVID isn't only politics. It's a personal issue. You yourself battled the virus over the summer. You spent a few days in the hospital. The headline said your condition was serious for a while.
The doctors said it.
So there's an expression in Hebrew, what you see from here, you don't see from there. You have a really unique perspective having been hospitalized for COVID-19. What did you learn about the health system from inside the hospital?
First, I learned that Israel has a wonderful public national health system. And I think that in the end, if we succeed to deal with this pandemic, it's mainly because of our excellent doctors and nurses inside the public national hospitals. And we need to remember it, because usually we talk about the policies of the prime ministers and about the governments. But the real strength of Israel in its combat against the virus is our strong, mostly egalitarian and accessible national health system. And we are fully committed inside this government to protect its public and egalitarian nature. The second thing I want to say is that before, I was in the hospital and after I was released, I'm calling all Israelis to get the shots. At the same time, one thing I must add is that my days in the hospital made it very clear that we are not talking about a simple flu. You know, part of the public debate here about the government policies is the fact that many people claim, you're doing a huge fuss about it. When it comes to young people, it's only a flu. Well, I can tell from a personal experience, it's not a flu.
We hope you're feeling well now.
Very serious in the way we address it.
We hope you're feeling well now. You sound good.
Much, much, much better. I think that my recovery belongs to the doctors and to the fact that I refuse to leave the committing the ends of the others.
Well, a member of Knesset, Gilad Kariv, thank you so much for being with us. One last quick question. The one important development or achievement that you wish our listeners to expect in the coming year from this government?
Look, I really believe that the former government didn't function. We didn't have a national budget for 3 years. So I think that the most important thing for the listeners to understand that after a few years of a dysfunctional political system, this government is stabilizing the political Israeli experience or field. We are regaining the trust of the Israelis in the democratic methods of going to the polls and then to have a government and not to run again to the polls. And I think that we will be able to lower the flames of the Israeli intensive and tense public debate. And people that truly care about the future of the Israeli society must understand that without achieving those important goals, we will not be able to move forward in any field of public policy and public action. I think that we are stabilizing the Israeli political scene, and as a result, we bring some quiet to the Israeli society, and I believe that the American listeners can identify with what I just described.
Okay, so stability and quiet will take you up on that, and maybe meet again at the next year's High Holidays and see what the mark will be. Thank you very much, Member of Knesset Gilad Kariv.
Shana Tova.
Shana Tova. And that's it for today's episode. Thank you so much, Alison.
Thank you.
And thank you to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back on Friday with Haaretz Weekend, this time with Simon as the host, and he will be chatting with Dina Kraft and Sally Abed, co-hosts of Groundwork, a new podcast about Palestinians and Jews refusing to accept the status quo and working together for change.
Until next time, shalom from Tel Aviv.